Thank you for listening to this sermon recorded at the Lost River Church of Christ. For more information, check out our website at lostriverchurch.org or call us at 270-843-3163. We consider it an honor to share the good news of Jesus Christ with you completely free of charge. Have a great day and enjoy the sermon.
About time to begin tonight. It's good to see everybody out. We've got a good crowd tonight, and I hope everyone's had a good day and are ready to end the day with a little bit of Bible study. We're going to be looking this evening, just a little bit of review at first, and then getting into trying to look at the life of a man by the name of Constantine, which some of you may be a little bit familiar with. I am a history person. So sitting and reading about individuals like Constantine is very interesting to me. I can sit and read about that kind of stuff all day long. The difficulty is in reading all this information about this man, trying to figure out, okay, how do I share that with everyone else and try to make some points that have to deal with the subject that we're studying. So I hope tonight, at least in looking at his life a little bit, we'll be able to see some things pertaining to the time of the church and some things that were possibly going on with individuals who were members of the church at that time also. As we started looking at the church, as we got into Acts and saw the establishment of the church and those kinds of things, and even going back before the establishment of the church with Jesus as he predicts what's going to take place, that he came to build a kingdom and be a king, one of the things that is discussed quite often is the idea of persecution. And that's something that, as we went through our study, we see right off the bat, the church being persecuted, and that was something that they should have expected because of what Jesus told them and things that were going to happen because of them following after him. Well, some of the next warnings that we find as the church has been established now and is kind of getting its footing and is, as we've seen in many places, multiplying and growing, and spreading all throughout the world at that time, some of the warnings that we start to find, I want to think about just for a second here as we begin by looking at a couple of passages. 1 Timothy chapter 4, verses 1 through 3, as Paul's writing to Timothy, who was a young preacher, who was going to be about preaching the gospel. These are some of the warnings that Paul gave to Timothy. He says, "Now the Spirit expressly says that in latter times some will depart from the faith, giving heed to deceiving spirits and doctrines of demons, speaking lies and hypocrisy, having their own conscience seared with a hot iron, forbidding to marry and commanding to abstain from foods which God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and know the truth." And then again in his second letter to Timothy, he once again encourages Timothy, saying, "Preach the word. Be ready in season and out of season. Convince, rebuke, exhort with all long-suffering and teaching. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but according to their own desires, because they have itching ears, they will heap up for themselves teachers, and they will turn their ears away from the truth and be turned aside to fables." Then Peter, who writes, and you can really look at the whole second chapter of Peter to get the idea of what Peter discusses, and he talks about the idea of false teachers also. But there were also false prophets among the people, even as there will be false teachers among you, who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the Lord who bought them, and bring on themselves swift destruction. And many will follow their destructive ways, because of whom the way of truth will be blasphemed. By covetousness they will exploit you with deceptive words. For a long time their judgment has not been idle, and their destruction does not slumber. So Peter, Paul, as they write, they discuss this idea of what was going to come after the church now has been established and is getting its footing and is preaching the gospel and establishing churches in different places. We also see John mentioning this idea in his letter, the first letter. "Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits, whether they are of God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world." And what's the thing that we find as you see Paul, as you see Peter, John, these individuals who were really kind of the beginning of the church, what is it that they're now warning the church of? We talk about persecution, opposition, but what are they now warning the church of as it's now coming into its own? Yeah, false teachers. Men that are going to come in and teach deceptive things, come in and teach things to lead people astray. Some of those phrases that you see in all those verses People will depart from the faith. They will not endure sound doctrine. They will turn their ears away from the truth. Many will follow their destructive ways. So you see this idea now as the church has been established and has been going now for a number of decades. Some of the writings now are turning to the idea of false teachers and false teaching and those kinds of things. The persecution's there, and they knew that, and they've endured that. But now, as the truth is being spread, as churches are being established, it's the false teachers that are coming in that they are being warned about. And we've seen, as we looked a little bit, some of the reality of these warnings coming to be. As we looked at those seven churches in Asia, we see some of that reality coming to be at the close of the first century. We saw that there were false teachers that came in. And one of the interesting things, you remember the church at Ephesus found some that were saying they were apostles and they were not. They found them to be liars. That's kind of interesting that we've talked a little bit, Scott shared with us a number of times, about some of the things pertaining to people who either claim to be apostles or linked to an apostle or something like that. And you see that all through the history of religion, really, even nowadays. You still have people that are trying to claim to either be apostles or somehow linked to an apostle, those kinds of things. And that was one of the warnings and one of the things that the church at Ephesus found. We had all kinds of false teachings that we discussed there, the doctrine of Balaam, doctrine of Nicolaitans, doctrine of Jezebel, the persecution, opposition. We saw all those things with the churches of Asia at the very end of the first century, some of those warnings that were given coming to be. And Scott also dealt with some of the things that we found as you get into the second century. Still the false teachers, false teaching, the idea of Gnosticism was something that was very prevalent at that time. And he talked about some of the moral issues that were coming into the church that they were having to deal with. The idea of divorce and abortion and immodesty and entertainment. And you might look at some of that list and think, wow, they were dealing with that then? Of course. Of course. And Scott even pointed out the idea that even more so some than maybe we deal with some of those issues. The church was dealing with that kind of morality and those kinds of things, homosexuality also. So we see those kinds of things pervading the church. But one of the interesting things about all of this is the church was able to stand against false teachers. And we see that with churches like Ephesus and other churches. They were able to stand against false teachers and false teaching and those kinds of things, as the church still stands today against false teachers and against false teaching. And you know, even in spite of all the persecution that arose among the church, what do we see happening with the church? All the persecution, all the opposition, what happened to the church? They grew, they prospered, they continued to expand in spite of all those things. So they were able to deal with false teaching and false teachers. They were able to deal with persecution and opposition. So what was it? What was it that caused the slight and slow and gradual departure from God's pattern? It wasn't really the false teachers, because they stood firm against those things, and we still stand firm against those today. It wasn't the persecution. That didn't steer the church away from God. It maybe took certain individuals possibly, but not the church. So where did the departure begin? Well, Scott mentioned it a little bit. Where did it begin and start? Inside. Isn't that interesting? All these things that were happening on the outside really didn't affect the growth of the church. People continued to grow and to teach the truth. It happened from the inside. It happened, as Scott mentioned there, the idea of leadership is really where the departure of God's people began, or the departure of the church, apostasy, maybe we talk about sometimes. But leadership and organization is where it really began, and that shouldn't surprise us either when we see Paul writing to the Ephesians. We've talked about this passage a number of times. Paul talked about the idea that there's going to be people that come in. When I leave, savage wolves are going to come in. So there's going to be false teachers. There's going to be people that try to lead people astray with teaching things that are misleading. But notice at the very end in verse 30, also from among yourselves, men will rise up speaking perverse things to draw away disciples after themselves. And that's really where we see the departure coming. The apostasy beginning, that gradual leaving of truth and straying and following after the ideas of men. We see that happening from the inside out. Scott talked about this a little bit, and we're just not going to spend a whole lot of time on it, but this is kind of the pattern of the departure from the early 40s A.D. You go to Acts chapter 11, and in verse 30, we find there the first mention of elders in the church at Jerusalem. And you look at other places like Acts chapter 14, when Paul's at the end of his first journey, he appointed elders in every city. or in every church. In Acts 20, we see him talking with the elders at Ephesus. And then, of course, in Philippians chapter 1 and in verse 1, we have a pattern there of bishops, deacons, and saints. And we see that's kind of the organization of the church according to God's plan, and the leadership of the church according to God's plan. And we see that holding true pretty much all through the first century. Not really a departure from that all through the first century, until we come to early into the second century. Scott talked about some of these early men, Ignatius of Antioch. In the early 100s, I believe Ignatius died in 117. So it was early on, toward the end of his life, early in the hundreds, that Ignatius began to distinguish between bishops and elders. And why would that be such a terrible thing? What would be the danger in that? Yeah. What is a bishop and an elder? It's the same thing. It's the same thing. Matter of fact, we have a number of designations or ways in which we describe elders, bishops, elders, overseers, shepherds, presbyters. We see all of those descriptions of the same individuals, leaders of God's people, leaders of the church. And as early as the beginning of the hundreds, we see that there was now a distinction made between bishops and elders, and that became a very dangerous thing in the pattern. About 140 to 150, we see the idea of a bishop. Scott talked a little bit about this idea that what ends up happening is you have elders in a congregation, and they get together to discuss the work of the church, and one of them would be described as the presiding elder. And he ended up taking that position, and then later on being known as a bishop. And what ended up happening is you start having a bishop and elders and deacons and saints. So you see kind of early on that slight, it doesn't look like much, but that slight deviation from what God's design was of elders, deacons, and saints. Now you have a man described as a bishop. And we see that taking place early on, 140 to about 150 A.D. I think about the example of Bowling Green. You know, there are a number of congregations in Bowling Green. And there's five congregations in Bowling Green that have elders. And you could say that Lost River, West End, Southside, Parkway, and Eastside all have elders. And what ended up happening is one elder out of those elderships ended up being designated as the bishop. And that was the kind of the pattern that we see taking place here, that deviation from God's pattern. Until about 150, when you start having congregations that have a certain man designated as a bishop, guess what ends up happening? Now those bishops start talking about getting together. So you have a man or a bishop from each congregation now coming together, and in 150 to about 200 AD, you start having councils of these bishops coming together, and it started to expand the authority to groups of churches, known as maybe what you've heard before as a diocese. So what you now have is these groups of bishops coming together and having authority or rule over a group of churches, known as a diocese. And this was something that was supported by some of the early writers also, Irenaeus, Tertullian, some of those type of individuals promoted these ideas, which later on began to grow. And it just keeps expanding from there. You see this idea of the bishop that is over the diocese being known as a city bishop, under which he has country bishops, elders, deacons, saints, and that would make up a diocese. And you just see this pattern of expansion. And it all has to do with the idea of the leadership. You have a group of dioceses now in a region that come under the oversight of what was known as a metropolitan, which was an archbishop. And you see how it expands and grows to the idea now you have a metropolitan over a diocese, over a city bishop, over a country bishop, over elders, deacons, saints. And you can see how it just keeps on going from there. You finally get the idea as this metropolitan starts coming into being, this archbishop, the bishop of Rome began to gain prominence. Why would the bishop of Rome be the one possibly to gain that prominence? It was the capital of the empire, so it seems that, you know, if anybody's going to have some prominence, it's going to be the man from Rome. And that's exactly what took place. And we have a warning here. You got that, Scott? From there, you can imagine, as you see these metropolitans coming together, you see a number of them coming together. Finally, you would get to the idea of now multiple metropolitans coming together, and those eventually came under the rule of what we find as a patriarch. Yeah, you see the pattern there. It got to the point of a patriarch, metropolitan, diocese, city bishop, country bishop, elders, deacons, saints. And then finally it came to the point where there were five patriarchs over the whole Roman Empire. So you can just imagine this. You think of the idea of the Roman Empire and the church and the vastness of the church as it has spread to the whole empire now is under the rule or the oversight of five men. Five men. That's where it came to in the Roman Empire. And those five patriarchs were from the cities of prominence, Rome, Antioch, Alexandria, Jerusalem, and Constantinople, which is a difficult one for me to pronounce sometimes. But you can kind of see just the gradualness. This was over a number of hundreds of years that this took place, but we see the deviation from God's pattern at first being very slight, it seems. And as Scott mentioned, you know, when they first start distinguishing between these bishops and these elders, it was really to fight against false doctrine. It was all really originated to try to fight against heresy and false things, but we see where it led to over a number of years. So it was a dangerous thing, and it was something that was also predicted in the scriptures would happen that came from inside. So we see those kinds of things taking place, and those are some things that Scott also discussed a little bit in his couple of lessons, but wanted to review that just a little bit to give us an idea. As we get into the idea of Constantine now, this is kind of where the church was, or it was heading in that direction as Constantine starts to come into being. He was born around 272 or 273, so you can see from the date of his birth that it was about in the middle or so. Some of these things were already taking place, especially the metropolitans, I can't ever say that word either, but the metropolitans and those kinds of things were coming into being about the time that Constantine was born, around 272 or 273. His father's name was Flavius Constantinus. Flavius, I'll just call him that because the other one's hard to say, but Flavius, he was a military man, his father. He was a politician, also a very smart politician, was very versed in trying to lead people and knowing how to do that, how to sway people to his side. And he was also a very religiously tolerant individual, which was kind of unusual. What do we know about Christianity at this time in the Roman Empire? Were people very tolerant toward the Christians? Yeah, they were still outlawed. It was still illegal. They were being persecuted on every side. But we see that Flavius was a man that really, and I think a lot of it was part of his politics also, was very tolerant toward just all sorts of religions. And that's one of the things we'll see also in this tolerance toward religion. It had very much to do with gaining acceptance, gaining favor of various groups of people, because you were going to be a leader and you needed to have the acceptance and the favor of the people that were under you. So a lot of times the religious tolerance wasn't simply because they agreed with it or that they liked it or that was something that was a part of their life, but they needed those people. They needed that group of people to agree with them or to support them in their efforts of trying to lead. So that a lot of times was why people were so tolerant as far as religion. But Flavius was one of those kind of individuals. He was tolerant toward all religions. And we'll find that Constantine would follow right in the footsteps of his father in all of those things. Constantine also became a mighty military man. He was a political man. He was a very religious man, just as his father was. And we see him following in the things of his father. His mother's name was Helena. And we really don't know much about her because his father, after his father started to kind of move up politically and militarily, he ended up getting rid of Helena and marrying someone else's daughter that would help him in his progression of leadership and those kinds of things. So we don't know much about her. And Constantine's education, as far as we can find, was kind of a mixture of pagan and Christianity. Pagan coming mostly from his father, the Christianity most believed from his mother, possibly Helena. About the time that Constantine started getting into the things that his father was into as far as military and those kinds of things, we find from a period of about 235, I know up there we've got 270 to 300, the period of time before that, about 235 AD to 269 AD, those 34 years was a very chaotic time for the Roman Empire as far as leadership. In those 34 years, they had 26 different emperors. So you can see the upheaval and the change of leadership and just kind of the chaos of the empire at that time. When you get to about 270, though, things kind of start to smooth out a little bit. And we find that there were four men in particular that were somewhat the leaders. They were known as Augustus or Caesars. And we find these four men about this period of time, 270 to about 300, were the leaders. It was described, the Roman Empire was described at this time as a tetrarchy. And you may be familiar with that idea of tetrarchy. It means governed by four. And that's what we find the Roman Empire being at this time. After all the chaos of those 34 years, it kind of settled down under the rulership of these four men. And I'm not going to try to pronounce all of their names, but the one up at the top here, this man, Diocletian, you may have heard his name before. This was one of the periods in the Roman history that was most severe when it came to persecution of Christians. Diocletian was a very severe ruler, very intolerant of Christians and their religion, didn't like them at all, and severely persecuted Christians in the East. These two men ruled, really, they kind of split the kingdom right down the middle. Diocletian and Galerius were on the east, and Maximilian and Flavius, who is Constantine's father, ruled the west. As you can imagine, Flavius being a religiously tolerant man, the west was much safer for Christians at this time, whereas the east, with Diocletian and Galerius, both of them very brutal men, Christians were persecuted severely at this time. For those some 30 years or so. And one of the things that's kind of interesting about this also is Constantine comes into power. He's following in his father's footsteps, but Constantine has been placed under the leadership of Diocletian and Galerius. He's part of their army, and he's part of their council when it comes to politics and those kinds of things, and most believe that Constantine was put on this side to try to keep Flavius under control. You know, Flavius isn't going to get too far out of control or do things very contrary to these other two men if his son is under the rule of these other two individuals. So we see Constantine was kind of used as a pawn to keep Flavius in check. And during this period of time also, even though there were four men that were ruling and some of the chaos had ceased, there was still a major power struggle between these four men of who was going to be in charge. And there was constant fighting, there was constant distrust from all of these men. And that continued for a little while. A little bit farther on, about 5 years after that, we see that Diocletian and Maximilian both had aged quite a bit, and they were unable to continue on as far as their leadership, so they stepped down, and we see that everyone kind of just moved up as far as the power goes. Galerius and Flavius, who is Constantine's dad, were now some of the most powerful men in the empire. With the change of Diocletian to that of Galerius, Constantine, who was over here under their rule, when that switch came, Constantine and his father got together and Constantine kind of bolted. He was able to get out from under the rule of those two men, and he ended up meeting his father up in Britain, all the way up here in England, and was able to serve now under his father, where he was able to learn and continue his growth as a military leader. Which he became a great military leader, and as a politician, and of course, again, as a very religious man. So that was kind of an interesting thing to see him getting out from under the rule of those men during that transition. Unfortunately, even though Constantine was able to get out from under the rule of those men and join his father, that wasn't going to last very long. His father died about 2 years later, which put Constantine right into the charge of being one of the four leaders of the Roman Empire. And this was something that Constantine ended up being very good at. He continued his father's in his father's footsteps. He was a very confident military leader and had the confidence and the trust of his army, They loved to follow Constantine, and they served him loyally. So he had a tremendous following when it came to the army. He was also, along with his father, a tremendous builder of projects and those kinds of things, roads, buildings, those kinds of things. He really built up the empire at that time, just as his father also had. And then, of course, also he continued with his father's religious tolerance of all religions. And again, that was specially to gain the favor of those that were under him. So we see him kind of following in his father's footsteps, really riding on the coattails of his father's reputation at that time until his reputation became greater. And Galerius, and now we had another man over on the other side, Maximin. These two were still, of course, very intolerant of religion, especially Christianity, and there were still very severe persecution at that time. And these two here were constantly fighting. These two were constantly fighting. We see that continuing on for quite a while. We get to just a couple years after that. Constantine now had been ruling for quite a while. Galerius has been killed by this other man, Licinius. And of course, again, what we find is some fighting between these two and these two. Licinius eventually defeated Maximin and became the only one on the east side ruling. Constantine and Maxentius fought constantly also, and that's where one of the most important things in the life of Constantine takes place. About the year 312, we find Constantine and Maxentius fighting in Rome. There's a major battle that takes place at that time in the city of Rome, or just outside the city of Rome. Maxentius, of course, is trying to gain sole leadership of the West from Constantine, and he has come now to Constantine to fight against him, to take that from him. And Constantine's, or Maxentius's army is twice the size of Constantine's army. As he's coming to take this rulership, this leadership role from Constantine, he comes with his armies to Rome, and his army is twice as big as Constantine's, which poses a problem. Most of the time, if you're going to go into battle, you don't want to fight against somebody that's got an army that's twice as big as yours, but that was the case for Constantine. Well, the night before the battle, Constantine has a dream. And some of you may have read about this before. And in this dream, Constantine sees the image of a fiery cross. And there's a message that comes along with this fiery cross, and the message is, with this sign, you will conquer. And as Constantine is dreaming this and relays this to some folks in his council to try to find out what this means, it comes to be that this cross means to him that he is to accept Christianity. Of course, the cross being a symbol of Christianity, the death of Christ, the one who began Christianity. And Constantine has this dream with this fiery cross, with the message that he will conquer with that sign. And the next morning, he takes this sign and he paints it on the shields of all of his army. And as he goes into battle against Maxentius, guess who wins? Maxentius has an army that's twice as big as Constantine, but guess who wins the battle? You'll never guess. Constantine does. And this is the time now in the life of Constantine where most believe that he was converted to Christianity because of this dream that he had, because of this great victory in battle, because he put the sign of the cross on his shields, and that was supposed to be the sign of conquest and victory. Constantine now is a Christian. He has given himself over to Christianity and to the God of Christianity. So it's kind of an interesting story about Constantine, but that is something that is somewhat beneficial to the kingdom. We find as you continue on just a little bit further into the story that Constantine, of course, in the defeat of Maxentius and his army, Maxentius is defeated and killed, and Constantine now is the sole ruler of the western side of the kingdom. And Leontius, in his decisive battle on the other side, is the winner on that side and the ultimate leader of the East. Well, what ends up happening after a number of years here, as these two men now have become the leaders of the West and the East, they come together. I think Licinius, especially after seeing the great victory of Constantine and the great power, the great confidence of Constantine and the great support that he has from many of his followers in the kingdom. Lysanias agrees to come with Constantine, and they come together to try to work out a mutual agreement as they're together now. And that mutual agreement, as they come together in the year 313, was called the Edict of Milan. And some of you may have heard that. It's also described as the Edict of Tolerance. But Lysanias comes, and with Constantine, they come together and hammer out this Edict of Milan, or Edict of Tolerance, in 313 AD. And this Edict of Milan had a lot of interesting things along with it. It granted full tolerance of all religions in the Roman Empire. So you can just imagine the consequences of something like that. All these people that have been persecuted as Christians now, because these two men have come together and devised this edict, they've granted full tolerance of all religions in the Roman Empire, including Christianity. So there's no more persecution now on the eastern side over here, where there's been severe persecution for so many years. Now there is freedom. Now there's tolerance. And individuals are allowed to worship the way that they choose. They are allowed to follow the gods of their choosing, including Christianity and the following of Christ. Also, one of the things that was granted during that edict was that Christianity was now legal. You know, we talked about the idea of it being illegal under the reign of Diocletian and Domitian and some of those men, especially Diocletian. One of the things that Diocletian did was he confiscated all their property, took all their church buildings, all the places where they met together to worship. Those were confiscated. All those things were now returned under the Edict of Milan. Christianity was now a legal religion, and Christians were restored their church buildings and property that was taken under the rule of Diocletian. Christians were given civil and political opportunities, which again was unheard of at that time, for a Christian to have any type of opportunity in civil office or in a political office of any kind. That was just unheard of because, one, it was illegal to be a Christian, and two, most of them were poverty-stricken because they were Christians and just didn't have those kinds of opportunities. But now, with the Edict of Milan, those opportunities were given. Constantine also was one that granted Christians in many of his councils and those who were his advisors and those kinds of things, he had many Christians who filled those roles and those spots, which was, again, very unheard of for someone in his position as the emperor or the co-emperor of the Roman Empire at that time. So Christians were now being treated very well and were allowed to worship and practice their religion the way they knew that they should. And that was something that was given to them through the Edict of Milan, under the rule of Constantine. One thing that took place after the signing of the Edict of Milan in 313, there were a number of years where things were good, like we pointed out there. About 320, one of the things that takes place is that Lysanias, for whatever reason, goes back on his agreement. He no longer accepts the Edict of Milan and goes back to persecuting Christians in the East. And that was something, of course, that Constantine could not put up with. So he and Constantine go to war, and Constantine once again is victorious. And that was a number of years from about 320 to 325 where Lysanias went back on that agreement, and then Constantine and he went into battle fighting about this. In 325... Constantine now is the sole emperor of the Roman Empire. So there's been a number of years, a number of conflicts and battles and things that have taken place, but now in 325, Constantine is the sole emperor of the Roman Empire. And one of the things you may have heard about Constantine is that he is the first Christian emperor, or the Christian emperor of the Roman Empire. For the most part, he accepted the idea of Christianity, and he did a lot of things to promote Christianity, but I don't know if I would necessarily designate him as a Christian emperor, but he did promote Christianity in many ways. He sponsored the church financially out of his own pocket. That was something that he was very big on as far as being a religious man, was supporting the things that he believed in. Christianity was one of those things, and he believed in Christianity and those who followed Christianity, so he supported Christianity, along with many other pagan religions. But he did support Christianity and promoted Christianity. He built a number of church buildings throughout the empire, One of them was on the place where Peter supposedly was killed. It was known as St. Peter's Basilica. You may have heard of that. That was built by the old St. Peter's Basilica, was built by Constantine. And that was something else that was for him to show that he was in support and promoted the idea of Christianity. One of the things that we find also is that he granted privileges to the clergy, which we'll start talking about a little bit in the next class, that distinction between as Christianity starts to spread and to grow, and we see some of the deviation from God's pattern. One of the things that comes about because of that is the idea of a distinction between laity and clergy. Now, that's something that came along with that, and in his promotion of Christianity, Constantine granted privileges to the clergy, like they were exempt from taxes. Pretty good. Would make you want to be a clergy almost to have your taxes exempt. But that's one of the things that, again, Constantine did to gain favor, to show his acceptance of Christianity and those who were promoting Christianity. So he granted privileges such as those kinds of things. He commissioned copies of the Bible. It was said that he commissioned up to 50 copies of the Bible to the church in Constantinople, and also spread copies of the Bible all throughout the Roman Empire at that time, which would have been something that was, again, new and interesting. Most of the time, as we've talked about early on, all they had was word of mouth. But now copies are being made of the scriptures, and that was something that was promoted by Constantine. He encouraged that, and he hired individuals to make copies and spread those throughout the empire of Rome at that time. And then later on, toward the end of his life, just a mere 12 years after he became the sole emperor of the Roman Empire, he was baptized. Just before his death, he became very sick. As he was out, like many of the individuals that we read in history that were on military campaigns and those kinds of things, he became sick as he was traveling, and not necessarily on his deathbed, but very soon before he died, he was baptized. And that was, again, to show his acceptance of Christianity and to promote the idea of Christianity among those who were his supporters. And that was something that was very beneficial later on after his death for those who came after him and those who promoted Christianity along with Constantine. But we find as Constantine did all of these things as the emperor of Rome, as the Christian emperor of Rome, he still held very strongly to many of his pagan gods and pagan practices. One of the things that Constantine did quite a bit was build structures and build, sometimes you would hear about archways and things that were built to show victory and those kinds of things. And many times it would have symbolism of Christianity and symbolism of pagan religions. So there was always this mixture with Constantine between Christianity and paganism. Yes, Roger. Well, copies of the scriptures, not necessarily the Bible we have, but copies of the known scriptures that they had at that time. That, I believe so, as far as some of the things I've read, yes. Somewhere in that area, yeah, from some of the things that I've read. But we see that Constantine definitely was a promoter of Christianity and did many things to try to encourage Christianity and help Christianity as far as his understanding of Christianity at that time, but did still hold to many of the pagan beliefs that he had from his father and from others that were influences in his life. So that's kind of Constantine, some of the things that he did for the promotion of Christianity and to help along those who were followers of Christ at that time. One of the things that we're also going to talk about in the same year of 325, in the next class, we're going to look at the Council of Nicaea, which was a gathering of the bishops. We talked about kind of the deviation from the organization of the church and the bishops of all the different congregations. There was a calling of all those bishops together to talk about some certain doctrines and things that were going on, to discuss those things and come to conclusions about those things, and we'll talk about that. That was also in the year 325. And we'll talk about the Council of Nicaea next time, and a little bit more about some of the things that promoted the Catholic Church, the start of the Catholic Church, and some of the doctrines of the Catholic Church that came from the Council at Nicaea and the promotion as Constantine promoted Christianity at that time. The Catholic Church came from many of those kinds of things that Constantine promoted and some of the deviations that we had even before Constantine came into power. But we'll talk about those kinds of things a little bit later on. And also, if we get a chance, we'll talk about the Catholic Church some of its doctrines, and we'll also talk about the Church of England just a little bit maybe, and the split from the Catholic Church of the Church of England. So those are some things that we'll talk about this coming Sunday and then also Wednesday night. We got about 2 minutes left, but that's all I've got for this evening. Does anybody have any comments or thoughts at this time? Hey, Elaine.